Hi. So today on the Loopcast, we're talking about high-frequency trading bots. And to give a little background, I mean, this sounds, you know, our shows are kind of wonky, but now this is, you know, in a lot of minds of people, this is, you know, peak wonk, so to speak. But the reason we wanted to do this show is because, you know, we pride ourselves as a smaller organization sort of being either ahead of the curve or, you know, we're tackling issues from another angle. And previous in our series, in our InfoSec series, we've talked about the Internet of Things. We've talked about exploiting embedded devices. And you can refer to the episode on car hacking. You can refer to other episodes in our InfoSec series to sort of grasp what I'm saying. But, you know, what sort of has piqued our interest in our series isn't necessarily the exploitation of embedded devices or the direct exploitation of software, but rather the idea of introducing software and very complex software to industries where you didn't really necessarily have that software, really complex software, and sort of the software engineers and the financial engineers and all that sort of scientific knowledge, you know, coming in into an industry and sort of introducing complex software where, you know, it wasn't there to begin with. And so because of that, we're sort of interested in looking at the political, legal, and the institutional changes that introducing really complex software brings. And I think my guest, Haim Bodek, has sort of documented this perfectly through his sort of examination of high-frequency trade bots. And you could check out his work at HaimBodek.com and on Twitter at HaimBodek. And before we start the interview, I wanted to give a shout out to the person who introduced me to Haim, which was Daniel Bilar. What we did, we did a call out and saying, you know, does anybody know anybody on high frequency trade bots? And we were pointed in Haim's direction because of Dr. Bilar. So I want to start off with sort of establishing your background and, you know, your background and your sort of technical expertise and how you came to sort of research and engage and look at high frequency trade bots. Because I think we need to sort of establish that first before we get into sort of the gritty of high frequency trade bots.
Yeah, sure. Usually when I talk to an audience, it's really they're a bunch of insiders and people kind of already know who I am. There's a book written by Scott Patterson that gives kind of a, you know, biography of my career and, you know, even my childhood, and you know, culminates with me blowing the whistle on high frequency trading to regulators, which is what I'm known for in the industry. More recently, there's another movie, a documentary called The Wall Street Code, which, you know, also kind of goes through that process. That was just released in November. So I guess, you know, for the layperson, I'd recommend checking out the book Dark Pools and The Wall Street Code to get, you know, idea about, you know, how someone like me took the path not traveled and became a whistleblower, you know, an HFT whistleblower. But if we go back to the start, I can say very briefly, I started out actually working in data mining with very large data sets on a project that was funded by the Department of Defense called Massive Data Digital Systems. And we did projects, within national security space. And we also did projects in the commercial space, and the place where I kind of, you know, developed my core expertise was working on credit card fraud detection for using machine learning. And, you know, we developed models that would forecast whether or not a user of a credit card was using it in, you know, a fraudulent manner or not. And that was sold to Visa, and when I left that firm, there was a few hundred thousand transactions per hour. This is the 90s, high-risk transactions would be vetted by my software. Around that time, I got interested in applying machine learning to finance, and I just, I basically was in the right place in the right time, and I got a job at Hull Trading, which was founded by legendary trader Blair Hull, who is the trader who bought the bottom tick of the 1987 crash. So you can't imagine a better entry-level job into finance than working at that institution. Now, to fast forward, Hull Trading was acquired by Goldman Sachs. I ended up going to UBS. I ended up running global electronic volatility trading there. And the systems I designed there, when I left UBS, a little less than 10% of the U.S. options market was going through my algorithms, and quite a large percentage market share in other international markets. And then I went and started a firm called Trading Machines. And the timing of Trading Machines is maybe later in the interview we can talk about. It was either the best time or the worst time to build. I mean, it brought me down this path. But I launched this firm at the same time that high frequency traders were radically changing the United States stock market in, frankly, in collusion with exchanges. So that experience, Trading Machines failed, and one of my reactions to that failure was to become a critic of certain practices in the market, and that led me to become a HFT whistleblower. So I think I summed it all up there.
it was very good. So
yeah.
I'm sort of interested. I mean, before we, I want to sort of develop a comparison between what is considered automation in the markets versus the sort of idea of high frequency trading. I mean, how do they, if you were to compare the two, automation versus high frequency trading, I mean, how does that differ for the trader and for the sort of exchanges?
Yeah, I mean, for me, they're completely different concepts. When I started at Hull, most of the European exchanges had already gone electronic. The algorithms that I worked on, were automated trading algorithms, but and we did significant market share, 5% of a market, but we were not a high frequency trading firm. The term back then was electronic market maker or automated market maker. That's how we described ourselves. So we call ourselves EMM or AMM. And this term, these two terms, EMM and AMM, were used by algorithmic traders to describe the function that they did. From the late 90s, when I started, to around 2006, the term high-frequency trading really was not used. It, every now and then pop up, but it was not in any way used until this dramatic transformation occurred in the U.S. stock market. And then, a few firms that no one had ever heard of before kind of popped out of the woodwork in traded out of Chicago and other areas that were far away from Wall Street, and they basically created this HFT tradition. So one of my mistakes, which I talk about in my book, The Problem of HFT, one of my mistakes was thinking that high frequency trading and AMM and EMM were the same thing, and I got burned by not recognizing that until way too late. So now you may want to ask, well, what's the difference? Well, the primary difference is that high-frequency trading is trying to rapidly get in and out of trades very quickly. And the older quantitative trading traditions were less focused on that kind of rapid execution, and they were more focused on what we call hedging, which is offsetting risks with let's say correlated securities. So if I buy IBM, I can hedge some of my risk maybe by selling short Microsoft. So that, you know, that was the quantitative AMM, EMM tradition. And then all of a sudden you got these firms that were getting in and out of Microsoft in 10 seconds. And that leads to a question. Why didn't the AMM and EMM guys go that direction? Why weren't they rapidly we call flipping or scalping in and out of trades? And the answer is, we thought it was impossible. We thought that with significant competition, how could you possibly get in and out of a trade in 10 seconds and make a profit? You know, it didn't make sense. And what HFT is, in my view, is a tradition that changed market structure so that it could get in and out of those trades. So HFT, in my definition, was pretty much impossible until the market structure changed to allow these firms to do things that would actually be unnatural in the automated markets that had preceded these changes.
I'm curious if you can sort of go a little further into this sort of idea of scalping and sort of the primary strategy that is sort of driving high frequency trading. I mean, it seems like it's not just about speed, but also, what is the trade order type? What is, when and where to do the trades? Sort of walk us through this primary strategy that is utilized.
Yeah, well, there's a metaphor that I've been using. I mean, the origin of the strategy, the firms that I kind of refer to, I won't name the names, but, some of them can be as much as between 5 and 20% of an entire market. I mean, these firms got enormous, and, nobody even knew who they were in 2006. So these firms that did this type of practice, there's a general thing that you see in terms of the staffing. You see ex-floor traders, what's very noticeable is that many of these firms did not hire quantitative analysts until they got quite large and then don't really have many on headcount. So what you see in there is you have these floor traders, they're kind of the sponsors or the backers who grew up in the pits in non-automated markets. And they are kind of tied up with super developers, right? Guys that make the they hire a lot of people from telecom or people who are experienced with programming FPGAs, right? You didn't see these types of individuals. So you have these traders, you have these highly competent developers, and then the third piece, which is critical. I don't think HFTs have done a great job at leading people astray and kind of, with some smoke and mirrors, disguising the fact that basically having security lawyers on staff or in extremely senior positions is critical, because most of the activity that they do is within the gray areas of securities market regulation. So you have what I think of it is traders taking strategies that were related to, but in no way identical to, related to strategies that floor traders used to use in the pits, and getting them to work at massive scale, and getting them to work in a way that, in many ways, especially, and we'll talk about it later on, but in ways that can be argued either circumvent or even violate securities market regulations. So it's entirely different from quantitative trading when you realize that that's how the origin is, and that's kind of the staffing. The staffing issue. I mean, you have firms, some of the top firms now, either the president or the second guy in command is an ex-SEC lawyer. And it's like we had never seen that prior to 2007. You never saw ex-SEC lawyers run trading companies of scale. So, it gives you a clue of what the activity is.
So I mean, before we get onto this controversial issue, I mean, you know, in one of your presentations, you called HFT an artificial industry, that it's, you know, it's unnatural, so to speak. But I mean, could you sort of, what did you mean by sort of artificial industry? I mean, is this something that, you know, is not only recent but sort of almost fabricated? I mean,
yeah, I mean, that is my kind of official position. I mean, in the early 2000s, so these HFTs, and I should have actually, in your last question, you asked about, you know, describe the scalping. I mean, it's very, you know, you listen to some of the HFTs, like when in 2010 after the flash crash happened, and they were, you know, being challenged, you know, what do you do in the markets? And they say, well, you know, we, you know, buy a little bit lower than we sell. We sell a little bit higher, right? And the answer is that's actually true. When you go look at HFT strategies in detail, what is so perplexing about them is how completely simple they are. And, you know, people kind of resist that, and they say, you know, how do I know? First of all, you know, I have, you know, if you go read my history, you know, I had access to, you know, specifications, right? I mean, you know, I do my intelligence very well. I've been in the business a while. So I had, you know, access to, but it's also that, you know, everybody knows, I mean, this is publicly known, that HFT strategies are competing on a microsecond time horizon. There are only so many lines of, you know, code you can process in microsections. You can't have that much logic and that much intelligence if you are competing against other firms in microseconds. So these strategies are quite simple, but you know, what's interesting is that they are operating in an environment where you know, where they can be very, very successful, and they can do significant volume. And so what the argument here is that the exchanges changed their rules of what we call market structure, but market microstructure is what we call it. They changed their order handling rules. They changed the order types. They changed the technical interfaces to accommodate this style of trading. So what I'm basically saying is that, you know, that the strategies that I have critiqued or criticized are not, you know, or do not scale, are not that profitable, unless you run them in environments which are specifically tuned and which cater to those strategies.
So then I'm sort of curious, I mean, before we get into the larger sort of context, I mean, are these bots, the first of all, I mean, this is largely, I'm assuming, done by bots, you know, sort of automated programs. But, you know, from a technical perspective, would you consider them to be smart? I mean, do they just do the same activity over and over again, or are they able to sort of compensate and to make up for mistakes? Or do they just...
No, that's another kind of myth. I mean, I think it's really interesting how, you know, the media... I mean, these firms, all of the firms in the quantitative space are secretive. And if you have very, very simple edges and simple strategies, the last thing you want is for those to, you know, walk out the door. You may have heard of a programmer, Alenikov, who... you know, stole code from Goldman Sachs, and you know, has been in a prolonged you know, litigation and jail sentence and everything for like been at least 5 years, I think now. So that model is actually interesting to me. It's called the three-factor model. It's actually was developed at Hull Trading, where I worked. And, you know, that model that he took is actually quite sophisticated compared to these HFT strategies. But what's funny about that is that model was actually incorrectly classified by the press as an HFT strategy. So to the degree that strategies that exist, you know, such as that you described, that have intelligence in them, that have that are able to learn and adapt, for the most part, those are not actually part of the HFT subclass of algorithms. Those are, we use terms such as statistical arbitrage, but it's more of the quantitative trading tradition that you see those features. So I think the press really gets high frequency trading and quantitative trading mixed up. And I think the HFTs, they don't want to tell you, we have gotten, we trade 20% of a name by abusing regulations that were rolled out in 2007, right? They don't want that to be their tagline.
So I want to sort of get into the issue then. You know, it almost seems like you have software people on one side and financial people on one side. So are the sort of financial people able to sort of understand how the software works, or is it really, a matter of, as long as the software is making money, they shrug their shoulders? I mean, what is the relationship between the software engineer and the sort of financial side?
Well, there are individuals who bridge the gap, and I see myself as that. That's pretty much the kind of person I was. I mean, I started out as a analytical programmer working on those machine learning projects. But what happened when I got into finance is I started to become the guy who interfaced between trading, the quantitative, and the financial engineering groups, what we call it, and the development group. So I think of myself as the fourth axis in there. We use the term now strategist, but the beginning of my career, nobody even had a term for what I did. It was hard to explain to people what I did. But I was the guy who understood how the machine worked and how the trading function, development function, and quantitative modeling function all were tied together in a machine that could automatically trade. You think about the amount of expertise you need to tie those together. So I'm not an expert at any of those three areas, but I am I can hold my own in each each area for the purposes I need, which is to tie everything into a functioning algorithmic trading business. So these types of people, these strategist people, especially when high frequency trading became more predominant in the last 5 years, have really taken over leadership functions in many of the hedge funds and banks, and of course the trading companies, right? So it's not that the trading, the financial people, it's not what's happening is that they're being sidelined by a new breed of financial professional. They're no longer able to manage businesses that they may have been able to manage 10 years ago because they just don't have the technical competency to do it. So, it's kind of, in essence, a little bit of a revolution where the geeks took over. But, you've seen that in other fields. And the truth is that the traders and the financial professionals who did not keep up with that shift in market structure and automated trading, they're the food. I'll just be black and white. They're the ones sending the wrong orders to the market at the wrong time and feeding the it's where the edge is, which is what we call edge. What you've seen is this shift has dramatically changed the power relationships in Wall Street, actually. So,
wow. Then I'm sort of curious. Then, I mean, if the power relationship has shifted, I mean, do you see that, at top companies like Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan Chase? I mean, have those really big firms? I think those companies, occupy a lot of our sort of imagination about, being billionaires and, being very good at, commanding the market. I mean, have those big firms been able to sort of adapt to, you know, not only utilize, you know, high frequency, you know, trading, but also, you know, be successful at it?
No, I mean, I think this is the thing that people don't understand. Maybe I'll try to get a little bit more into the investigation that's ongoing with regard to my whistleblowing. You know, I can't disclose things that are not public, but you know, it's the framework here is that the I'll tell you a little bit of a narrative, but to cut straight to the chase, it's the banks are basically significantly behind the high frequency traders, and that asymmetry is in essence what caused high frequency trading to become, you know, at least in 2010 and 11 was approximately 70% of the U.S. stock market was oriented around high frequency trading methods. What people don't understand is the banks, for the most part, they may be successful in quantitative trading, but they were a complete flop when it came to low latency trading. Most of the major banks do not even have technical builds and do not even have servers in the what we call co-location facilities. They don't even have the hardware, never mind the talent. And one of the ways that they tried to address it is that they actually got into relationships with firms that did have expertise in high frequency trading. So, for example, you mentioned Goldman. Well, Goldman, has an affiliate relationship with a firm called Pico, which is their solution to providing clients with high frequency trading access. But Goldman Sachs itself is in no way known as having this kind of high frequency trading competency. Actually, if I was going to rank them, the banks, I would actually put a firm like Goldman a little bit lower than some of the others. So what you have is the exchanges are courting these new high frequency trading firms, and they are providing environments that are tuned to the strategies. You know, they're basically advantaging high frequency traders by providing them features. So the way, think of video game culture. It's like getting upgrades, right? I'm a lot better if I get the BFG in Doom. I mean, I'm showing my age here. It's from the 90s. But, I want to get the extra armor. I mean, when you go look at what the features are, they literally look like upgrades, right? You're like, oh, wow, I can jump to the head of the queue? Great. Give me that feature. I want the feature to budge everybody else. I mean, it's a little bit surreal and kind of, I'll use the word dystopian. That's what's being provided, and that's how exchanges have competed. At least for the last 5 years, they use the word innovation. But what they're really saying is we're going to help you make money. That's how the exchanges are competing. They're attracting high-frequency traders saying, we're going to give you an edge. We're going to give you extra features that allow you to make more money. And the question is, where is all this money coming from? A lot of people come to me and they're convinced that I'm somehow, protecting through my whistleblowing the retail trader. But they don't understand is the retail trader's order is not even going to the exchange. The retail, if you trade through Schwab or through Ameritrade, your order is probably not even going to an exchange. It's literally being sold to what we call an upstairs market maker, a wholesaler, where it is traded against without any competition, right? So the retail guy is not even in the game. He's actually, often this other, sometimes we use the phrase dark pools or dark liquidity to explain. But the technical term is actually internalization. So retail guys are not even part of this game. So who is the other side of that trade, that high-frequency trade? Well, it is a mutual fund like Fidelity or T. Rowe that is being routed by a major investment bank like Credit Suisse or Goldman. And so you asked me, you know, have the banks caught up? I'm basically saying that the banks are the mechanism by which, you know, institutional orders from pensions and mutual funds are routed to exchanges that cater to these predatory HFT practices that I've exposed. That's basically how it works. Now, why would they do that, right? And, you know, there's a little, you know, people try to understand the logic. Well, what another thing that I should kind of emphasize here is that changes in the market structure that were initiated by a body of regulation called Reg ATS basically allowed banks to set up what are known as dark pools and ATS's alternative trading systems. These were basically pseudo exchanges that the major banks would run, and pretty much every major bank has one of these. And Goldman's called Sigma X. And when banks started doing this, they were shifting to start competing against exchanges. So you have to realize that, you know, an exchange is going to look at Goldman and to a degree is going to consider Goldman a competitor because Goldman's running a dark pool which competes against them. And right now, it's around 40% of U.S. stock volume, you know, close to that, is being routed to these dark pools and these upstairs internalization units away from exchanges. So, you know, exchanges are going to cater to their best customers and their allies, which are actually not the banks.
So then these larger exchanges, I mean, do they see, you know, high frequency trading as a threat then? I mean, or is it something to sort of to gobble up and to sort of take the smaller HFT exchanges and sort of integrate them?
So you're talking about the exchanges. Well, there are five major exchanges, 13 total exchanges. Five of them basically have the bulk of the volume. Four of those are HFT friendly and you can basically accommodate HFT strategies through special order types, order matching engine practices, price feeds, and all these basically these upgrades you can get. And the last one, NYSE, is still oriented around kind of an upgraded version of the specialist system, which also has its own asymmetries in it. So, when we talk about exchanges, we are basically talking about for the most part, the HFT playground. There are upwards of 40 dark pools in the United States, and there are hundreds of broker-dealer internalizers, and these are the firms that I said buy that Ameritrade order flow and trade it upstairs. So when you look at this entire ecosystem where you have, you know, over 50 places you can trade a stock, and then you have, you know, hundreds of firms that will try to take orders and trade them away from the market without competition. When you go and look back at the exchange space, you become, you know, you might be a little bit more sympathetic because it's very, very hard for an exchange to attract volume in this type of environment. One of the main problems exchanges have is, when I talked about an upstairs broker dealer buying order flow, we call it payment for order flow. You might ask the question, why would they do that? Well, what they do is they buy orders that they can make a profit off of, and they have mechanisms to determine if it's worth literally how much is it worth to buy an order from Ameritrade to trade against it. They can price that. That's one, you know, call some financial engineering. It's actually quite sophisticated. You know how much you need, you should pay. To, you know, so if you can make a third of a penny, you might be willing to pay a quarter of a penny to make a third of a penny, and then you net 0.05 cents. So this puts the exchange in a this practice puts the exchange in a terrible situation, where they're only able to attract volume that is what we call in the industry jargon toxic. So what you have is all of the big, you know, the way an HFT may look at the pensions order flow is they say, you know, how am I supposed to make money buying something when that huge firm is dumping all those shares? I mean, it's going to go down when they dump those shares. How am I supposed to make money buying, some, you know, what we call toxic order flow? You know, not buying the order flow, but, you know, buying it when buying at a certain price when that firm is selling. So I would argue that, and I've had the private discussions with HFTs, the way they think of the advantages and the supercharges, you know, supercharged features that they get and that are tuned to their strategies, they say, this is a necessary evil. I can't even make money if I don't have this. This just levels the playing field between me and the toxic, you know, mutual funds and pensions that are getting routed by the big guys like Goldman and Barclays. So there's a lot of justification and a lot of conflicts of interest in this ecosystem, where all of the players you know have some type of justification on why certain practices that they know are either gray or you know unethical. You know they know that in essence that they're getting an advantage over, you know, other participants, and basically everybody thinks, well, this is necessary because if I didn't have that advantage, I'd be out of business.
So before we get into sort of looking at the law and sort of ethics and sort of, you know, these other issues, can you sort of explain to me a flash crash? Because I think we've heard of this before, and I think it's something in the popular, you know, lexicon in regards to sort of high frequency trading. But sort of explain to me, what is a flash crash and how high frequency trading is sort of involved in these sort of mini and somewhat temporary, you know, crashes in the market?
Yeah. So these events are basically when, in a very short amount of time, you'll see a dramatic change in the price of a security. You know, the flash crash is, you know, the over a period of 10 minutes, in 2010, market tanked nearly 10%, and then, you know, pretty much rebounded back afterwards. And that pattern of rebound you see in these mini flash crashes, which will occur not in the broader market, but they will occur in single securities. And a few years ago, there was a paper that came out that it noted that there were, that, you know, at least maybe about 2 years ago, there were, had been noted about 25,000 of these things. And what's interesting about them is they are not as prevalent in other markets, and seem to be, I think people understood that they are related to electronic trading in the U.S., but they're not understand. They don't really understand, you know, how. And the thing I want to kind of point out, what an HFT will say is that these flash crashes are created because somebody sends an order out there that is, you know, too aggressive a price. It's an incorrect order. Sometimes it's a mistake, what we call a fat finger. Somebody gets price and size mixed up. SEC has been on the record saying that the flash crashes, the mini flash crashes they looked at, a lot of them are initiated through human error. But what you see in the case is you see a rapid flurry of algorithmic trading activity throughout this mini flash crash, and then you see most often you'll see a correction in price. So the price will literally, you know, go down some cases 20% and then pop right back up. So sometimes these mini flashes can only last a couple seconds, And if you are an investor that had a stop loss order or some, you know, some type of order, or acted at the wrong time during one of these events, you can be horribly, you know, penalized, have significant financial impact from these things. So, you know, how is it related to algorithmic trading? Well, one thing to understand about high-frequency trading strategies is that they are reacting within microseconds to the same general a class of signals. And one of the most important signals that they react to is a large trade occurring. Most of the strategies are trying to scalp a very small profit margin, and many of the strategies do not like to hold a lot of risk because I already told you that the trades on exchanges tend to be what we toxic, or you know, what we call adverse selection. There's actual adverse selection bias in these trades. So HFTs have learned that if their strategy gets a lot of risk piled onto it, the odds are that that is going to be, you know, they're going to end up buying a lot of shares when the market's going down, for example. That's the kind of experience. So they keep their risk constraints very tight. We call it inventory limits. And what that basically means is that HFTs are not providing a lot of liquidity. But the thing that's bad is that they're also acting with with extreme, you know, rapidity. They're acting at the same signal. So what happens during these mini flash crashes is let's say I admit it. Let's say I say, okay, it is mostly triggered by human error. But what's happening is you get a hot potato chain reaction where the big order comes in, it hits the market, and the HFT algorithms will see that the big order hit. They will see that on the price feed. Or even worse, they'll actually get hit with the big order. And they know when they get hit with a big order. And what they do is rapidly try to exit it. You see? And they're all acting at the same time. And they act so quickly that, you know, some of the slower algorithms out there don't have time to come in and correct it, the price. I mean, sometimes these prices are ridiculous. Of course I want to buy there, right? But what happens is they move the stock through their cancellations. It's not even that they're trading aggressively. It's that they're withholding liquidity and exiting the market in a synchronous manner. And that causes, you know, think of it as the bottom of the market to just fall away. And that's what you had during the 2010 flash crash also. And once you get a certain movement and a certain degree of volatility in short term, usually most algorithms out there, even if they are slower and more quantitative in nature, none of them want to take a big bet when there's an event, news leaks, you know, a pre-announcement of earnings. So most of the strategies will actually, you know, protect themselves from trading when there's any type of big move. So what you have is an entire ecosystem where the interplay of high frequency traders and the rest of the market participants create, basically a self-fulfilling prophecy in these liquidity gaps, is, you know, what we call them, or these mini flash crash situations. So, you know, it's really everybody's to blame. But I will say, prior to HFT becoming dominant in the market, you really didn't have, you know, 15 firms all pulling their prices out of the market in the same, you know, 5-microsecond interval. And that's what's so different. And that's probably the reason HFT should be held accountable for this activity in the market.
So let's get to that. We've discussed the science, we've discussed sort of the financial aspect of it, but what is the legal, like, what is the legal framework, the regulatory framework look like when it comes to HFT? I mean, is this something that is, you know, fluid? Is it being, you know, constantly redefined? I mean, what is, you know, try to guide us through this, you know, regulatory framework.
Well, so the thing that is, you know, there's a deep irony in the ascent of HFT. Now we're getting a little bit more into, you know, what I'm specifically known for. But in 2007, there was a quite ambitious body of regulation called Regulation NMS, or Regulation National Market System, that was introduced into the U.S. And it was approved in 2005, and the firms that became the largest, you know, most successful HFT firms were just hitting their stride around 2005. They weren't making a lot of money, but they were doing a lot of volume, and they had very good relationships with the exchanges, and the playing field was basically starting to become, you know, more and more unlevel in favor of HFT strategies. And Regulation NMS was just, it's just fascinating to me that you know, there's a series of rules in it. Rule, you know, 610, market access rule, 611, the order protection rule. I mean, if you listen to these names, the order protection rule, right? The purpose and of intent of Reg NMS was to bind these 13 exchanges and these 40 dark pools into a coherent national market system where the investor was protected. That was the purpose's intent. And if you go look at how Reg NMS tried to achieve this, it tried to basically manage with very precise mechanisms how prices were allowed to change, how they were disseminated across the market, what fees people were able to be charged across, you know, between competing venues, you know, questions about discrimination, you know, disallowing trades. You know, it was impermissible for trades to occur at inferior prices. You know, the market itself had to ensure that trades were occurred at or within what's called the national best bidder offer. So it basically tried to tie this fragmented marketplace into a single coherent, what we call national best bidder offer, which is basically the best buy price across all exchanges, best sell price. They're quite ambitious. If you go look at the details, every one of these rules interfered significantly with these HFT strategies. Reg NMS should have destroyed the entire HFT industry, right? And the HFTs knew this. They were heavily involved in comment letters, in lobbying, in, you know, and did everything they could to convince regulators, you know, prior to 2005, while this was being debated, you know, to create exceptions to allow certain, you know, behavior. And so what Reg NMS also had was a number of gray areas and exceptions which benefited or could be used to benefit professional traders. And so prior to Reg NMS being introduced into the U.S., HFT volumes were between 25% and 30%. And what you see is this inflection point, and after Reg NMS comes out, the volumes just explode, and the market goes HFT. And that's when the press starts using the term aggressively, and it's, you know, considered this big innovation. But really what it is there's an intimate relationship between HFT strategies and I'm going to say it very clearly, the way that Reg NMS was implemented, right? We have a body of law, but remember, this has to be translated into computer code. We have an automated market system, right? So these laws get translated into the order matching engines and these major stock exchanges, which I've argued cater to HFT. And it also describes how the prices have to be disseminated by kind of these contracted bodies that will disseminate the national best bidder offer to all the markets, and it's in that translation that things start to go bad. And then it gets worse after that, in that this period of what the exchanges call innovation, where they introduce all these special features. I'd say, like, about, I'm going to guess here, but about 70%, you know, that's my estimate, of the primary features or innovations that HFTs use to make money are basically designed to interpret or, you know, pseudo comply with Reg NMS in a way that's favorable to HFT. So when we talk about special order types, you can see in the press that the CEO of the ICE, which just acquired the New York Stock Exchange, he's been in the press saying most of the order types that NYSE Arca has, which they acquired, are oriented around Reg NMS. So, you know, to be very simple here, HFTs hated Reg NMS. If it was implemented in the way that probably the regulators envisioned, it would have protected the investor, protected institutions, pensions, and mutual funds, and it would have basically destroyed these high-frequency trading businesses. Instead, what happened is the exchanges produced innovations, which I'll say, you know, innovations in quotes, which allowed HFTs to circumvent, rules of Reg NMS, either by using explicit, exceptions, and those are okay, I guess. You know, they're some of them are not, and it's not really great that we pass those, but at least the exceptions are transparent. But in some cases, it's just interpreting gray areas in a way which are, when you look at the details, you're like, how did that feature ever get through? You know, how could anyone have justified, a queue jumping feature that allows an HFT to jump ahead of a mutual fund? It's like, how did that get through? You know, it's all, was all rolled out within the context of, providing innovations to assist sophisticated traders in complying with Reg NMS. So, I'm kind of getting into some details here, but the main defense that exchanges have against most of my complaint is that the SEC approved all these features and that it's okay. It's permissible to have an HFT queue jump a mutual fund. It's literally what the argument is. Why? Because we submitted some filing and the SEC rubber stamped it. Well, if you go look at the filing, it says nothing about queue jumping. And that's where things get quite legal.
Interesting. So then I'm sort of curious. I mean, this might sound more philosophical, but I mean, do you, as a software engineer who's working for one of these exchanges or one of these firms that employ HFT, I mean, do you have to register as a trader? And even, further on, I mean, do you have to register the software as a trader? I mean, what is, how does the law, how does the regulatory framework engage the software engineer and the piece of software that's being used?
Well, it's so far behind the other industries, you would be shocked. Well, in the late 90s, there was actually in Europe a practice where you had to register your algorithm, this was a reaction to it was a smart reaction to this changing landscape when Europe went electronic, but they did not, there was no practice of registering algorithms in the U.S. This was strictly European exchanges, and then that requirement was at some point eliminated. Of course, the algorithmic trading firms hated this because any type of registration of algorithm, you'd have to provide some color on what it did, and trading firms consider that to be their confidential information. So now your second question is really about, is a developer required to register? And the answer is no. The developer or quants are not required to register as a trader. They're not actually required to take the examinations to this day. And what this causes a real problem. It's been a problem for me just in managing developers. There is a group at UBS that I was a kind of sponsor for where there was a committee that had to manage around 70 quants and developers across all these different units that used our shared technology base. And you can imagine how difficult it is when you have a team like that if the developers and quants are not educated in securities law and do not understand what's compliant and not compliant. It's actually quite difficult to catch every single, misinterpretation of requirements. I mean, developers will tend to make decisions based on performance, right? And pride themselves on certain kind of, and this is, called cultural, but I've had situations where a guy's like, I don't want to check whether or not that order has the correct price and size because I checked it in this other process. And I say, look, you could have a bug in that final process, and if that gets out the door, then we could have a night, you may have heard of the Knight Capital debacle. We might have a nightmare situation. Now that would actually be a compliance breach, but back then it was just simply a risk control issue. So you have situations where the people who are implementing your code, guys who know how to program an FPGA are not going to know the details usually of how obscure exceptions in regulation NMS operate. And that's probably part of the problem of where the industry went is from my perspective, there's quite a number of people in the HFT space who have implemented unethical features and don't even realize, they just think, well, hey, that exists, I can do it, the exchange doesn't have a problem with it, it must be okay. And of course, that's the feature that the SEC has been investigating for 3 years right now, So the developers are divorced from the trading and compliance aspect, and it's a big problem.
I mean, on the flip side, does the financial side, do they understand the software? I mean, it seems like the software guys don't really care to engage the laws and sort of the regulations, whereas the financial guys don't necessarily understand the software, the code, APIs, whatever. It seems like the problem is a lack of knowledge on both sides.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to use other industries, but how well, does a sales guy, maybe who sells a fire, let's say we have a tech company and they make firewalls, would he be able to, audit code within the firewall to determine if it was acting appropriately, right? I'm using that example because a lot of people in the financial industry who are not part of black box operations are tend to be customer facing. We call them sales traders. Okay, their job is to execute with the software, in the market, they'll take commissions and they'll work orders, and I don't think it's actually, you shouldn't expect them to understand, an algorithm that's written in an FPGA, within the core of the system. If everybody's interests are aligned and everybody is compliant, that's probably not a problem. But when you realize that trading is a bunch of smart people, think of it as, similar to how a casino operates, right? It's a zero-sum game between participants, and it's you'll see that that lack of knowledge is a lot one of the big reasons why certain firms and certain people can make money off other people. I mean, it's basically an information and competence asymmetry. So, I don't know how to address it. I don't actually think we should go and turn sales traders into algorithmic trading specialists. I think we need to get the regulators, the level of competency within the SEC in terms of catching, think of it as in a casino, right? You want to have some, the most important thing is having people who can catch cheating, right? And that's how you can have different skill of gamblers, but as long as there's like some base level of enforcing the rules, it's okay. Well, the problem with the market right now is that the regulators, and if you go look at some of the newspaper articles on this, one of the big problems they have is that they can't even hire full-time market structure experts as full-time employees. It's primarily there's all these positions for lawyers, but there are only recently have they started to create positions for developers and market structure specialists and quants. So you really have a regulatory body that doesn't have the technical competency to catch violations within the within software code.
Wow. I mean, to sort of further elaborate on your point, I mean, what has been the role of regulators? I mean, how has, you mentioned the lag in sort of understanding and sort of catching up with HFT and sort of the use of software, but, what has been the greater role of regulators? I mean, have they been able to regulate the space in one way or the other, or is it really...
One thing that's kind of disappointing is I've told you that, some of the people, I wish I could tell you these conversations, but some of the people that I respect and they're on the pro-HFT side and I'm a critic, but, some of them are ex-SEC lawyers. So it's like you have a situation where it is extremely lucrative for a very smart person who's worked at the SEC to just join one of these firms. I like to be an optimist and say that the SEC is responded to the feedback from the industry. They've put a significant amount of looking at the issues that I care about. A lot of them appear to have been corrected in 2012. So I've seen direct impact in terms of things that I was upset about that are highly nuanced and most people don't even know about have been eliminated. So, they're able to do that, but, I question, if they're able to do that, if there aren't people, I'll toot my horn here, if there aren't people like me who are willing to basically, be watchful eyes on the practices and to bring that information to the regulators, I think it's very, very difficult for them to keep to regulate this industry.
So I think we've come to sort of my last question that I had for you, which was, it strikes me the issue of HFT, it's an intersection of software development, security, and the economy. So I'm sort of curious, how can the tech and policy community get involved in sort of understanding and changing how companies utilize HFT? Is it really an uphill battle and sort of
one thing, I'm going to be a little bit pro. So I used to work, as I said, in machine learning, data mining, we would do, we'd go to the supercomputing, the annual supercomputing conference, and it was surrounded by a lot of people who were just super, super smart when it comes to technology. And also very, very aware, you had a huge, over the, especially in the late 90s, you had the privacy movement. You have lots of activism in the tech center. So you actually have people who have pretty much the full competency to go look at the issues that I've exposed and to make assessments. What's interesting is over that period, I kind of started my career during the dot-com era, and nobody wanted to go to Wall Street then. I mean, that was the 2000s after where after the dot-bomb, where finance became in vogue. But I remember, I basically say my friends who were outside of finance, who were technical, were always superior to the best people that I knew in the industry. So the people in the industry aren't actually that good, okay? They're super programmers, but in no way do they compare to the people I met when I did, the Terabyte Challenge, which was a data mining competition of supercomputing, the conferences. And so the problem here is it's actually a lack of knowledge and a lack of interest. There's, for some reason, the people who could bring a lot to this debate, who could bring, who could critique it from a technical perspective, have not actually been part of it. And I think you mentioned Daniel Bilar at the beginning of this, and I've had a number of very interesting conversations with him. And he's obviously a genius. You can just tell right within 5 minutes of talking to him. We don't have anybody like that, in this industry. I mean, if we do, they're on the other side and making a lot of money. They're not critiquing it. They're not making the economic system of our markets better. They're basically taking advantage of the lack of expertise. So I guess I'm throwing it out there. I'm that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast with you, is I I'm a bit frustrated that, most of the people on Wall Street don't actually have the technical competency where I can literally tell them how their order is being abused, and it's too hard for them, and they can't act, right? They just want their broker or someone else to solve it. So one of the problems is we don't really have a vibrant technical debate on the features that I've disclosed out there. I've written the foreword for a book, which is, it's a novel, but it's written by a technical person. It's coming out soon, and it was kind of exciting to work with him a bit. And he started looking at some of the API manuals for the exchanges. He goes, this stuff isn't documented at all. How can they say it's documented, right? He's looking at it from the perspective of someone who's worked in computing and expects a certain base level of documentation, right?
Right.
And he's looking at the specifications that I'm making the claim that this is undocumented. The only way you can figure out how this works is talking to the exchange, and maybe they'll tell you, maybe they won't. Depends if you're HFT or not, right? And he's looking at it, he's like, oh my God, I cannot believe that they're claiming that they've documented their order types, and this is what the document looks like. So I'd love to get 20 more people like that with a fresh perspective to come in and look at the mechanisms. Everything that I'm talking about can be debated, a much more concrete level with real specifications, real APIs, real regulatory filings. It can be challenged. But the problem is, as I said, the people who can conduct that debate are pretty much working at HFT firms right now.
Wow. So before we go, we always like to have the guest to give us a last word or, give the audience something to chew on. I mean, I guess the previous hour is a lot to think about, but, something to leave our audience with and to sort of get them to think about what we've discussed here.
Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, my experience over the last few years, I mean, I thought when I first started this kind of path that I was just going to point out a number of features that, were obviously unethical, very likely illegal, and should be shut down. I thought it would be over in a few months. And what's really interesting is how, on one hand, I've been kind of pinned to this issue in that, you know, I'm kind of like the guy who just said, I'll hold the torch and I'll go correct these issues. And what's been really interesting about it is that across the board, the basic reaction I get is, you know, you're right, and we kind of wish you hadn't done this, right? You know, and at the end of the process, I look at it and I go, why did I do this? Who was I doing this for, right? I was upset about this stuff. I wanted to go away. But, you know, this question of whether or not this should be a national issue for the public has gone off and on, right? The topics I've talked about today have been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. There's a documentary about it now. There's been Senate hearings addressing this. There's been two major investigations ongoing. It's proliferated enough that, you know, it's basically shown a light just enough on the real issues of the industry to make everybody uncomfortable. But we're not really at that point where there's been, you know, social change. And what's really interesting to me is the resistance. It's not just HFTs. It's the entire ecosystem, you know, and there's various reasons why. But you don't see the outrage. I mean, some of it, frankly, is that there are people, especially on what we call the buy side, the mutual sum pension, they are terrified of the class action lawyers, right? Because there's a fiduciary duty for best execution, and that's called into question by my complaint. But the real question I have for your audience is, you know, does it matter? You know, is this a national issue? At first I thought, yeah, it's the U.S. stock market. It's everyone's pensions and mutual funds. It's supposed to be the basis of our economic system. It's supposed to be protected. Reaganomics is supposed to protect investors. It was circumvented, right? On paper, it looks like that people should care. But then the reaction I get is, this is too complicated. Or, you know, I had one friend of mine said, look, it's only what $3 billion a year. It's not that bad. You know, so they, you know, unethically skim $3 billion a year through these means. I mean, that's for the entire market to work. That's not such a bad, you know, cost. And it's kind of a little bit perplexing. So I guess I am offering the topic up because, you know, at some point, you know, I think I've kind of mentioned to you that many of the things I was most concerned about have actually been corrected, and most people don't know they've been corrected. At some point, I say, okay, I'm, you know, maybe this wasn't, you know, maybe I was going down the wrong path. Maybe we as a society don't want our markets to function in a fair and transparent manner. Maybe we don't want the investors to be protected by Reaganomics. You know, I just bought the Kool-Aid of a better market, you know. So, you know, it's a really a question of at what point is this just a Wall Street thing, an internal debate, or is the end consumer and the investor part of the equation? And, I'm hoping that having other smart technical people like, you know, Daniel Pilar look at this might help me answer that question.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.